Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Lewis came out of that car, walked straight up to, well, not straight up to me, he had to do the way in and the podium and all the rest of it. But after that, came to see me and said, Matt, do the maths. If I win every single race for the rest of this season, can I still be champion?
It's lights out!
Hello and welcome to the Cut to the Race podcast. Today with us we have Emma, Will, Matt, but we're not actually that interested about that because we have a special guest. Matt Bishop from Aston Martin F1 team. How are you, sir?
Very well, and how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm really good. Thank you for joining our show. It's an honour to have you on, and we've got some very, very good questions lined up for you. So we're going to start with you today. Normally we start with the news on our show, and we talk and have a little gossip about what's going on in the F1 world. But today we're going to go straight to you, because I think you're a bit more interesting than the news this week, to be honest with you. So
you're being far too... I'm scared now. You're obviously going to ask me... You started off with all this flattery, and now you're going to give me some horrible questions.
Yes.
We figured if we were scared, you had to be as well.
So for the listeners that don't know you, Matt, do you want to just give us a little overview of yourself?
Well, look, in terms of my Formula One time, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So, look, I've been in Formula One for, I don't know, 25 years or so, a bit more. I started off as a journalist and then became an editor and journalist. First of all, for F1 Racing, which is now called GP Racing. But I also had a column on Autosport in the magazine, the paper magazine, and on the website. And I ended up being part of the team that kind of developed the website, really, with John Noble, for instance, is still very much involved, as you know. And then I went to the dark side. I was hired by Ron Dennis, and he was very personally hired by Ron Dennis. We had, and I joined McLaren. And spent 10 years there as communications director. And then I did 2 years at W Series, very different, which we may or may not have time to talk about. I know you're a Formula One podcast, but we could talk about it. It is interesting. And then literally only about 6 weeks ago, I started at Aston Martin Cognizant Formula One team, which, of course, is a team that I've known for so long. I mean, the founder... Eddie Jordan, I know very well. In fact, I missed a call from him at 5 a.m. this morning. I don't know what he's thinking about. Anyway.
Wow.
So I did. I woke up and saw that I, you know, 0507 or something, missed call Eddie Jordan. he was always a bit of a weird one, old Eddie. I love him very much.
I'm sure he'll be listening.
Anyway, he founded the eponymous team in 1991, as you know, and then it went via Midland and Spyker and Force India and Racing Point, and it always punched above its weight. And I always admired it, actually. And now I'm working for it. But, of course, now it's got, sorry, Eddie, a much better name over the door, Aston Martin. And to be involved with Aston Martin, bringing back, because it is back, bringing back, you know, one of the world's most prestigious and admired automotive brands back to Formula One, the top tier of global motorsport, after an absence of 61 years, that's got to be something that you'd want to be involved in. And I'm incredibly privileged to be involved in it. And I can't wait, you know, for us to launch our car, which is coming very soon, and then to go racing.
Matt, I have known you for a couple of years now. We actually met at Autosport a couple of years ago when you were launching W Series and I was a budding writer. So that's where I met you to begin with. But how did you actually get into motorsport? Is it something that you've always been interested in that led you into a career in journalism and then Formula One?
No, a lot of people, particularly, you know, I'm 58. So my generation, a lot of boys were, you know, taken to motor races by their dads, sometimes their mums and sometimes girls. But in my generation, it was often a thing that dads took their sons to. That wasn't the case for me at all. My dad is a concert pianist, musician, has absolutely zero interest in Formula One. He doesn't mind cars, but absolutely zero interest or understanding, comprehension, or even patience with it, actually. Completely uninterested. Totally uninterested. And anyway, he and my mother split up when I was two, so he wasn't much around at that time. But I was one of these nerdy kids that walked down the road, you know, toddled down the road, as a young toddler, 2 or 3 years old, pointing out cars. I'd say Austin Cambridge, Morris Oxford, Wolsey Hornet, you know. Of course, these brands are completely date me now, but I would be able to pick them out like that as a kid. But I didn't know there was a thing called motor racing. You have to realize I was born in 1962. And in those days, in the 60s, motor racing, Formula One, was a minority sport. I mean, a real minority sport. We now look back with rose-tinted spectacles at the wonderful exploits of people like Stirling Moss and Jim Clark, Jackie Stewart, and so on. But it wasn't on the television, wasn't even reported in the newspapers. On television, until 1978 in the UK, only the Monaco Grand Prix and the British Grand Prix were on. Just occasionally another one might be on. Yeah. Really. So let's say the 1973 Brazilian Grand Prix, for the sake of argument. It wasn't on television in the UK, not even at all. No highlights, no nothing. It also wouldn't have been, the result might well not have been broadcast on the radio or on the news. It wouldn't have been in the paper the next day either. It just might have been. It wouldn't have been in the Sun or the Mail or the Mirror or the Express. It just might have been in the Daily Telegraph in 4 point at the very, very end with the croquet and the bowls, you know, those kind of sports. And even then, it wouldn't say, there would not be a report. It would just say, first, Emerson Fittipaldi, Lotus Ford. Second, whoever it was. Third, whoever it was. It wouldn't say who was on pole. It wouldn't say that, you know, Carlos Reutemann had led the first 40 laps and then his engine had expired. It might not even say if somebody had been killed.
Good Lord.
It was really, really, really minority. You would begin to find out about those things later, and you had to buy Auto Car on the Wednesday or Auto Sport on the Thursday to find out. Now, I'm giving you that background because it really, in the 60s and early 70s, that's what it was like. At school, there wasn't a single person who was interested in Formula One and probably hadn't even heard of it. But I remember I was a keen footballer, and my mum gave me a choice of one magazine that I could have as part of my pocket money, and I chose Shoot. Shoot was a weekly magazine, football. And I went to the newsagent one day to collect my copy of Shoot, and I saw this magazine on the desk, Autosport. And I looked at it, and I think it was in about 72 or 73. I was probably about 10, something like that. And I looked at this car, which I'd never seen the like of before. I now know what it was, Jackie Stewart's Tyrrell. But there was this blue car with huge tyres and a great big airbox, and with a man's head sticking out the top of it. I'd never seen it. You have to realise, it was impossible to see these things. I just stared at it, and I asked the newsagent, I said, what's that? Autosport, mate. But what's that? What's the car racing? I didn't know. You have to realise it was that minority. And I said, can I swap my pocket money from Shoot to Autosport? And that was when I was about 10. And so that swap was effected. And I probably haven't actually missed a copy of Autosport over the past half century, whether I've got them all or whatever. Probably looked at them all. And
a true enthusiast.
Yes. And I realised that was an epiphany for me. That moment was an epiphany. I realised how extraordinarily unusual it was. I thought a sport had been invented specifically to cater for my very, very eccentric peculiarities, which were that I was interested in both cars and sport in this way. And I didn't realise they could be combined. And I remember then going to school and talking, everyone thought it would be equivalent now of an 11-year-old who went in and tried to persuade his mates to get awfully excited about croquet. They think he was a weirdo, wouldn't they?
That strikes me as eerily similar to the American coverage of F1 now, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, it is very different now globally, but particularly in the UK. But we can talk about that. Much of that had to do with James Hunt in 1976.
With your time as communications officer at McLaren, that kind of helped set the stage and molded your relationships with the prominent figures of the sport. How has that altered your writing style to be so conscientious of the mission, objective, and statements of that team?
I went to the dark side. You know, I was a journalist, and I still regard myself as a journalist and a writer. And in fact, I've written a novel quite recently, which not a lot of PR people have done. And the subject matter is very different, by the way, as if in case you may or may not have read it. But look, I think there is no job in the world more fun than being a Formula One journalist. No job in the world more fun, particularly, if I may say so, at the time I was doing it. Prior to digital, you know, there weren't websites when I started off doing it, and there was a magazine that I was the editor of called F1 Racing, and it was the best-selling Formula One magazine in the world. It was the best-selling motorsport magazine in the world. And just this little group of mates, because that's what we were, me, Peter Windsor, Darren Heath, great photographer, Tom Clarkson, various others, many of whom, of course, are still involved in the sport, as you know, and some who are no longer with us. Alan Henry, great friend, passed away, lovely man. And we just decided, what are we going to put in our magazine? And what are we going to say about these people? And the world had to pay attention. So it was enormous fun. And we did make mistakes, of course. Formula One then, as now, is very secretive. You know, journalists ask questions, they don't always get the answers. They have to try and extrapolate as best they can, and you sometimes get it right, you sometimes don't. And that's something that teams don't actually necessarily always understand. You know, they complain, look, he's got that wrong. Yeah, but when they asked about it, we said that we wouldn't give the answer. So what do you expect? You know, if you think about it. And I think it's given me an advantage as a comms man, having had such a long time as a journalist prior to being a comms man. I think it's a very great advantage to a comms person to have had a long stint as a journalist. Poacher turned gamekeeper. It does help. You understand the process better if you've been looking at it from both sides. So your question wasn't exactly that, I know, and perhaps I've slightly evaded it and answered a different question, but it's vaguely adjacent. My own writing style, I mean, you know, I love writing, but in much of one's time as a PR person or a comms person, you know, you're not really writing. You're writing corporate writing, aren't you? You're writing press releases and so on and so forth. It's a skill. It might not be an art. Whereas I do think that writing journalism, even specialist journalism, even very specialist journalism, is an art as well as a skill. And I'd certainly claim that writing a novel is an art as well as a skill. Doesn't mean I'm any good at it, but but it's an art as well as a skill.
I've certainly been enjoying it so far, Matt. So
the vast majority would beg to differ on that.
No, I've noticed in the background, I think I can see a Lewis Hamilton at McLaren, I think, on the wall, which brings me to that topic, which during your time at McLaren, you were there when Lewis obviously started and you saw him evolve and change, begin his domination in Formula One. So what was that like, seeing young Lewis come in against Fernando Alonso and taking on the established drivers?
Well, I'll do better than that. Look, I'll angle that up and you can see there. So that's, you've seen Lewis, that's Lewis, a picture of Lewis on the wall. You can't quite see it, but those are the boots that Lewis wore to win the 2011 Abu Dhabi Grand Prix.
Good heavens.
So there we are. And I put them in a little box. So there we go. Now I'll hide them again. But I've got a few bits and bobs. And those are mostly motor racing books behind me. I have lots of books, but mostly motor racing. Not all, but mostly. So Lewis, look, actually I didn't join McLaren until the very end of 2007. So I wasn't there for his first year. But of course I was reporting on it. And I'd been a journalist for a long time already. I was hired to McLaren because of Spygate, which was when McLaren were found to be in possession of 780 pages of Ferrari IP, as you remember. And they had a bit of a nightmare going on. Ron decided he wanted a strategic comms director. And fortunately, he really had to have somebody who he knew and trusted and could do it. And it so happened that those three circles on the Venn diagram intersected at only one person, actually. But he knew, trusted, and had the experience and contacts to do it. So luckily, I got the job. But anyway, you asked me about Lewis Hamilton, and I'll tell you about Lewis Hamilton. I worked, obviously, with him from 2008 to 2012, five seasons, worked very closely with him and got to know him very well. First of all, I have always said that there were three drivers that I couldn't separate in history. And you know I love the history of the sport, as well as the present. But I've always said there are three drivers that I couldn't separate, which were Fangio, Clark, and Senna, from different eras. So obviously Fangio from the 50s, Clark from the 60s, and Senna from the 80s and 90s. But I'm going to put Hamilton in there now. I think you have to. I think Lewis Hamilton, not just arithmetically because of the magnum opus and what he's achieved, but the scintillating pace of the man, the fact that he has always dominated his teammates, including his first teammate when he was a rookie. Okay, he only scored a few more points and they both had four wins each. I'm talking about Alonso in 2007. But to do that against a man who had just won, who was a double world champion and in fact just won the last two world championships, and to come in as a 22-year-old rookie and do that, sensational. And he's never had a season without a win. And he hasn't always had great cars. I know he has in recent years, but I remember 2009 very, very well. There's a technical term for what that McLaren was. Shitbox was the technical term.
And that's from the Nicky Lauda dictionary, isn't it?
Yes. For the first half of the season, that was what it was. And yet he absolutely ragged it. And it was fantastic. I'll tell you, look, so first of all, I'm saying that Lewis Hamilton is up there and there's now four drivers, not three, that I would say is inseparably brilliant. And I know people will disagree and say, what about Moss and what about Prost and what about Schumacher? Okay, we can have that argument. It'd be much nicer if we had a nice glass of wine to have it over. But for me, those four. And of course, I rate all the other ones I've just mentioned as well. But I'll tell you a few stories about Lewis. I mean, first of all, brilliantly quick. Nobody, even his detractors, can say anything about that. Brilliantly quick. Super successful. But a little anecdote I'm going to tell you is around 2009, when we had such a bad car to start with, McLaren. And he had already been ahead of Heikki Kovalainen when the car was good the previous year. But in 2009, when the car was not good, the gap between them grew. And I think that was not only, you know, Lewis, who was obviously able to drive fast, a fast car, but also was able to grab a not fast car by the scruff, which we haven't seen much in recent years because he hasn't been called upon to do that because the Merc has been so good. But I remember when we finally got to Hungary and the McLaren team, McLaren engineers, had just little by little, in iterative ways, had improved that car. And it wasn't good in fast circuits. It had been all right at Monaco, but it had been terrible lots of places. Terrible at Silverstone, embarrassingly at home. Terrible in many fast circuits. We got to Hungary and we slightly fancied ourselves. We thought we just might be able to spring a bit of surprise because, of course, the Hungaroring is twisty and slow. And if you remember, what happened is Lewis won. He won the race. And most of us, if we're honest, were feeling relief. That was the overriding emotion from Ron Dennis down. Everyone, relief. Thank God we haven't had a disgrace of a season. We've won a race. With one exception, Lewis. Lewis came out of that car, walked straight up to, well, not straight up to me, he had to do the way in and the podium and all the rest of it. But after that, came to see me and said, Matt, do the maths. If I win every single race for the rest of this season, can I still be champion? Do the maths, do it now, do the maths. And I thought that's so indicative of how Lewis was and is. Mm. You know, he wasn't at all relieved. Relief wasn't part of the makeup. It was, can I now go and win the world championship again?
Good Lord.
And that is how he is. That is how he is. And that is the mark of a winner. And Lewis Hamilton is a winner. And I remember at the end of the time we spent with Lewis in our team in McLaren, 2012, of course, being the last year. Anyway, he won a few races that year, and then we knew he was going off to Mercedes. And I was disappointed. Didn't blame him, because, you know, a change is sometimes necessary. And he'd been with us for so long. He joined the team, really, at age 13. Really. And, you know, here he was, 26 or whatever he was. And I think, you know, that it was a rites of passage. He wanted to go and do something else. And, of course, history's proved him right. But a lot of commentators at the time thought he was making a very bad decision. Fact, hindsight has now proved that it was the right decision, very much so. But I remember thinking at the time, you know, we're missing a trick here. We should not let him go. And there were people saying, oh, well, he's got too big for his boots, in McLaren, I mean, and he's quite difficult. And guess what? He was. He was difficult, and he probably still is. But you need to have the best driver. That's what you need to have. And then you earn your money coping with those difficult aspects of that person's character. The way I always put it is this. If we were making movies in the 1950s. Would we want Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe in our movie? We would. Would they be very easy on the set? No, they'd be a complete nightmare, total nightmare. But we'd have them because we'd have a blockbuster, because they play well at box office. And then we would earn our money by looking after them, making sure that somebody has peeled Marilyn's grapes and everything's happening the way Clark wants it. But you wouldn't want a B-movie actor in an A-movie, and you wouldn't want anyone other than Lewis Hamilton in your team. Of course, you'd also want Lance Stroll and Sebastian Vettel, but I'm talking about McLaren.
There's the truth. Oh, yeah.
I can't help it. But at McLaren in those days, what you wanted was Lewis Hamilton. And it was a great shame when he left.
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break, and then I'm just going to pick on that point about those other two names that you've mentioned, and I want to get some thoughts on those two. Welcome back. As we said, we are with Matt Bishop today, and he's talking about some interesting things from over the years. We've spoken a bit about McLaren, Lewis Hamilton. I want now to get into some of the juicy information about what is now Aston Martin F1. So how does this team vary from what was Racing Point last year?
Well, obviously, I didn't work for Racing Point last year. I've only just started. I'm both an old boy and a new boy. Old boy in Formula One terms, but new boy to the team. I've been at the team since January the 1st. I had worked as a journalist for years and for McLaren and then W Series, but I had a couple of meetings with Lawrence Stroll, which I found fascinating. Fascinating character. I think very, very impressive. Obviously, I wouldn't have joined if I hadn't thought that. Very impressive. Limitless ambition. Limitless. And I suppose that's what attracted me to the team, because I thought, I've always admired the team. I've always thought they punched above their weight back in the Eddie Jordan days, but all the way through. And I have great admiration for Otmar Szafnauer and Andrew Green and Andy Stevenson, who I know quite well, and many of the others. And really that team, in order to take the next step, I mean, it was fourth in the constructors last year and really should have been third. And as near as damn it was third, had the car to be third. But to make that next step is huge. It's incredibly difficult to go to second and, of course, first. It's incredibly difficult. But the thing that impressed me is that, I mean, Lawrence Stroll will benchmark any business that he's involved with in no way negatively against anyone. So he's not frightened or fearful about Mercedes-Benz or Ferrari or Red Bull or McLaren or any of these other grandee names. And we are now a grandee name, by the way. You know, to bring Aston Martin back to Formula One after an absence of 61 years, one of the greatest brands in the world in automotive terms, Aston Martin, incredibly exciting. So my answer is, compared with Racing Point, because all the Racing Point people are there and all the great things about Racing Point are still there, and all it needed, I think, was new overall leadership with limitless ambition, and that is being provided by Lawrence Stroll, and more money. And that too is being provided by Lawrence Stroll. And also, by the way, by Aston Martin, in the sense that if you pick up the phone to a sponsor and say, hello, I am Racing Point, would you like to sponsor us? They say, Racing what? What? What's that? Whereas if you say, we are Aston Martin, we are entering Formula One for the first time for 61 years, would you like to be on our journey? yes, we would like to talk to you about that.
You're the James Bond chaps. This is probably a good move for us, yeah.
And between now and when we launch our car, which will be in early March, this is a Valentine's Day massacre that you've done. I realize that. Anyway, it's so when it goes out, between today, not tomorrow, today, the 14th of February, and when we launch our car in early March, we will make a number of sponsor partner announcements. And that is because people, I think, are beginning to like what they see of what is happening at our team. They can see that Lawrence Stroll means business, big time, limitless ambition. They can see that we brought in a four-time world champion, 53 Grand Prix winner, Sebastian Vettel. I personally think that Lance Stroll is incredibly talented, and I think that it's going to be exciting to see the way he develops. And I think people have underestimated that boy. I think he's a serious prospect. And with the money that the new sponsors will bring, and with Lawrence's leadership, I don't see any reason to negatively benchmark against us, against anyone else. Now, am I predicting immediate success? No. Rome wasn't built in a day. It takes time. It's difficult. Improvements are iterative and gradual. And the target is not stationary, because we have huge respect for our competitors, and they are also working as hard as they can, and they're brilliant people and well-funded. I'm talking about Mercedes and Red Bull and Ferrari and McLaren and so on. So it's not a static target, but we are going to back ourselves to catch them up. Our target for this year has to be third. I mean, it'd be limp if it wasn't, because we nearly had third last year. So our target has to be third. Doesn't mean I'm predicting it, but it has to be our target. But then stepping up to second and first, all I will say is, I won't say when, but Lawrence Stroll would not be in any business if he wasn't aiming to achieve at that level at some time.
You've just touched upon my next question, Matt, actually. You know, there has been a lot of talk that Aston Martin will not want to be coming into the grid feeling like a midfield team. They will want to be challenging the top teams. What do you think is probably the realistic expectations, especially with the rule changes coming in, you know, this year, and then the bigger ones next year? What do you think are the realistic expectations for the team?
Well, there are not that many rule changes for this year. There are some, of course, basically performance trimming rules, but not huge. Very big ones, obviously, yes, for 2022. But I'm not going to make precise predictions. It's foolish. It really is foolish to do, because there's too many conflicting variables. People have sometimes said, "Oh, do you think you'll beat your old team, McLaren?" Well, that would presume that one knows, A, how good one's own car is going to be, and B, theirs. How could one possibly say? It's a foolish thing. Obviously, it's something people will watch, because two big names, Aston Martin and McLaren, both with the same engine in the back, so it will be of interest. But I'm not making prediction. I would say that we will be up there, you know, and that's what Otmar says. And you've probably seen he's been interviewed, and he's said that. We will be up there. We aim for third. We're not predicting third, but we aim for third. And my goodness, 2022 is going to be fascinating. But I just hope it's going to improve competition, because whoever wins, it's not ideal if the same person always wins, much as I love Lewis.
You went through the progress. So like yourself, I'm very, very much interested in the history of F1, and something that is always I always love learning about is the relationship between drivers and their team and the public. You know, Jim Clark for me is a huge hero, and that just speaks to me that, you know, a really honest boy, and he communicated with his limited, admittedly at that time, fan base. So with your roles with Lewis, as you've spoken very affectionately earlier, and now with your new role at Aston Martin, you do work very closely with drivers, and we know that Sebastian Vettel, he's not overly keen on social media, which is a shame, because I think a lot of us in the UK would love to see him kind of give a bit more of a personal side. Lance Stroll does seem to be quite into that. But it's difficult for a lot of us to get to know them on a personal level, you know, because there is that divide. So I was just wondering if you could sort of enlighten me as a youngster as to, you know, how are those drivers in person, and how have they maybe influenced, I don't know, the way that you deal with people or the way that you look at different things in life?
Well, they vary so much. You asked about Sebastian and Lance. I'll just quickly say, yeah, Sebastian isn't a fan, doesn't seem to be a fan or a devotee of social media. Each to his own. That's life. He's also very... he's fun, he's witty, and we've seen him on television being very fun. I remember him also, you know, at the Autosport Awards one evening doing brilliant Kimi Raikkonen impressions. You know?
Yes.
Which you may have seen as well. So he's a very witty person and also hugely intelligent. You know, I've heard the phrase performance engineer behind the wheel, which I think is a good way of describing his approach. And Lance, yeah, Lance is, you know, they are very different in age. You know, Seb is 50% older than Lance, do the math, 22 and 33. Gosh. So it's quite a big gap. But Lance, fantastic potential, and yeah, a bit more open, as you'd expect from a person that age to social media. And we'll probably see a bit more of that now. Now, going your broader question, I mean, it's very difficult to answer a question, what are drivers like, which is in a sense what your question was, because of course they vary so very much. Formula One drivers have an abnormal life, obviously they have an abnormal life. And one of the interesting things to trace is when they retire and then have to become ex-Formula One drivers. Now, they may still be, you know, by all normal standards, very, very wealthy men, even though they're not earning at those levels anymore, but they've managed to squirrel away quite a lot. And they won't have to, you know, go and work in McDonald's, obviously, but they may have to go to work. And then you see a difference. And I remember something David Coulthard said to me once, which is, I now realise I'm not as witty as I thought I was. And I said, why is that? He said, because when I was a Formula One driver, I only had to say the word bum and everyone would fall about laughing. And it actually isn't that funny, is it? And now I have to work harder if I want to make someone laugh, because they were kind of, you know, kowtowing to me. And I think that is quite a thing, not just in Formula One, but in sport, in showbiz, anyone who has fame. In fact, I have a theory that people, the rate of people's maturation slows the moment they become seriously famous. Michael Jackson, just think about that for a second. You know, think about when he became properly famous and what kind of an adult did he become. Now, that's at one obvious extreme. But I think being famous is not, being very famous is not particularly easy, is quite a challenge for people, and that does apply to all sports people. But I've never worked with, this is absolutely true to say, I have never worked with a Formula One driver that I didn't like. I've liked all the Formula One drivers that I've worked with. Doesn't mean to say that I've liked every single Formula One driver that I've met in my whole life, but every single one I've worked with, I have liked and could see, you know, the nervily brilliant man within, and that's what they all are. They are utterly brilliant, but like all of us, they have their nervy moments as well. But I have only a few that I would regard as real friends. But there's a number that I would say I'm friendly with, which is a different thing.
Just as a follow-up to Will's question, from the outside, Lance seems to get quite a bad rep in the media, especially from a lot of fans. Do you think that, like, the changes within the team... You know, bringing Sebastian on board, he's a four-time world champion. He has got a huge amount of experience, not just on the track, but dealing with like the media side of things as well. And then having yourself in the team, do you think that will probably have a positive effect on Lance in regards to how fans will perceive him?
I don't know Lance well yet. I mean, I don't know Sebastian well yet. I mean, I used to interview him. As far as Lance is concerned, I know him less well. So I might annoy you, but I would probably hold fire on that answer because I don't feel, you know, ask me again in 3 months when I know him better.
Would you pop back on to give us your answer?
Okay. I genuinely think he is seriously talented. There's a lot that goes together, has to come together to make a great Formula One driver. And, you know, he is 11 years younger than Sebastian. But in terms of talent, I think he's absolutely right there. But ask me again when I've got to know him.
As you know, Emma's our kind of our writer for the team. Ollie does a massive amount of back end stuff and also runs our podcast. And Matt's one of our personnel chaps. I do all the video and it's something I've been doing freelance. And so one of the most interesting things about F1 to me at the moment, and it has been for the last year, is really the way that young drivers like Lando Norris and in some ways a bit like Pierre Gasly have been utilizing social media and genuinely, I think, changing the world's perception of their team through their personality. And it's an incredibly powerful thing. So with that in mind, I had a specific question to your job, which is that I wonder if you have any plans or if you know that there are any plans in place for Aston Martin to either go down the McLaren social media route, which is very much kind of honest with the fans, showing the lighter side of F1 and just having a lot of fun with it, or if you're going for the kind of Alfa Romeo approach, which is less is more, let's take our time over this video. We don't mind if it does incredible numbers because we're providing a set of products and our fan base know that they're not bothered. I want to get your feedback on that.
Well, again, early days. Aston Martin is a different brand from McLaren, but obviously an older brand, 108 years old. But also we want to use our Formula One platform, which is new to the brand, just to perhaps open up some communication avenues that haven't always been so opened prior. So I would say not necessarily exactly like McLaren. McLaren is McLaren and Lando Norris is Lando Norris. And also, by the way, that we saw the rapport between Lando Norris and Carlos Sainz. And I don't think that was forced. I think that was genuine.
Very natural, yeah.
So I think, we will see. But yes, look, you may have noticed that Rob Bloom has joined Aston Martin Cognizant Formula One, and he was at McLaren. In fact, I hired him to McLaren some years ago, and now he's with me here. So, we'll probably do some of the same things, I should imagine.
Excellent.
You mentioned earlier, the fascination you developed both as a petrol head, getting into the cars, the, dare I say, silent audacity of a driver hanging out of that vehicle you saw on the cover of Autosport. With us coming up as the younger generation of F1 fans, we kind of have that same fascination, that same sense of heroic worship, for lack of a better phrase. However, we can't really compare Sebastian Vettel to Jackie Stewart's different eras. But going into the mindset, I know you may not be able to elucidate very much on it. Do you think the changing of environments and cars, and specifically for Sebastian Vettel, that there could be a different mindset within the team and how that affects the driver or how it affects his performance, et cetera, underneath the Aston Martin brand?
I think he wants to have a lot of fun. And for him, fun obviously includes doing well. For all sports people at that level, they're not going to have fun if they're doing badly. But I think he's He's raced successfully for a number of teams. He's won championships. He's won races. And, you know, he could have, we realized that he wasn't going to continue where he was. That was going to happen. He could have done a number of things. One of the things he could have done is stopped. But I think he decided, I mean, just the same things as I've said. He spoke to Lawrence Stroll. He saw the limitless ambition. He believed in it. And he also thought it might be some fun. And I think, you know, he's right. And I think that's why he joined us.
Matt, we've done a whole podcast episode aimed to answer one question, which is asked all the time in F1, which you can probably guess what I'm going to ask, but is it the car or the driver? Now, with Mercedes domination, it's brought up a whole sort of social media whirlwind about it's just the car. Anyone can win in that car. If I ask you the question, is it the car or the driver?
It's such an irritating question, isn't it? Let's be
Preach it.
Because, look, of course it's both. We understand it's both. Of course we understand it's both. We know very, very well that Jim Clark was hugely successful in the 60s, but in Lotus 25s and Lotus 33s. And if you'd given him poor cars, then he wouldn't have done so well. That has applied in every era of the sport. It's applied to Juan Manuel Fangio, who was very adept at knowing when to leave a team and join another. Just talked about Jim Clark, who never raced in Formula One for anyone other than Lotus, but Lotus was always among the fastest cars at that time. Senna, of course, always quick, and always in quick cars, and now, of course, Lewis. And anybody else you want to mention. So, of course, it's the car. But the fascinating bit about it, surely, is the difference that the truly great drivers can make in that same car. And if you're not interested in that, then you're not interested in that. I can't do anything for you. You know, that's just not something you're interested in. Some people don't like it. Some people don't like football. Some people don't like cricket. Some people don't like golf. What can you do? But I'm not mad about golf, but I wouldn't start telling you that Tiger Woods is only good because his clubs are better than
I wish you'd talk to some of our commenters, honestly.
It would be irritating if I were to do that. All I will tell you is let's talk about the current most successful driver is Lewis Hamilton, and he is in the current most successful car. We understand that. Would he be good in another car? Yes. Would he always win all the races in another car? No. But please explain to me, if it's only the car, why he consistently beats his very, very quick teammate.
Thank you. We're on exactly the same page.
We need to try and condense that for some of our fans, because people need to understand that.
From the highest authority in the land. There it is.
Finally. I like to think of myself as a bit of an old soul. I'm a big fan of kind of older things. I don't know if that makes me just not really with it. But one of my favourite TV programmes is The Saints with Roger Moore. And he goes round, as some people know, I see you're a fan or you're acquainted with it. There's an episode where he goes to a Grand Prix. And obviously this is all filmed in the kind of the late 60s, I believe. And there's a load of people with champagne. There's these big banners. Everyone's dressed absolutely immaculate. It looks fantastic. But we've had a global recession going on for, you know, many, many, many years now. F1's changed a great deal. Is the glamour still there?
We can't be glamorous if I'm in it, can it?
Let's be honest. No.
But, it's a funny question. In a way, because you've described something that's actually a fictional depiction,
admittedly.
Course. But there is something, Monaco is a glorious irrelevance, isn't it? All those yachts, all those, and the idea of
tax relief,
driving a car around there, I mean, which Nelson Piquet famously said, like riding a bicycle in a bathroom. If the Monaco Grand Prix never existed, had never existed, and you said, now, I've got an idea. Let's run a Formula One race around there. They'd take you off, you know, they would
put you in a home.
You would not get a proper hearing for that rather extraordinary idea. Yet it exists, and it is a glorious irrelevance, I would describe it as. But, and still a sporting spectacle. It's hard to see the glamour if you're in the middle of it, and I suppose I have been in the middle of it for quite some time, but it is glamorous, and so it ought to be. And I actually also share your view, which is I like wearing rose-tinted spectacles. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll see that I like, you know, for a long time, I don't quite have enough time to do it anymore as much as I did, but I do this hashtag on this day, such and such happens. And I like finding ludicrously arcane little details about people that nobody's ever heard of anymore. and hopefully a nice picture. That fascinates me. But is it glamorous? I've never really loved the sport for its glamour. That's never really been what turned me on. And I'm not an engineer, so it wasn't really, you know, excitement about the engineering of the cars. I know a little bit, but it's not what thrilled me. What thrilled me, because I do love sport, but what thrilled me was because I am a petrol head, the combination of sport with cars. And although obviously I never want anybody to come to any harm, but the admiration of the daring as well and the sheer speed. And if you think about it, when I loved the sport, and you're talking about the Saint, so it is that kind of era, the late 60s and early 70s, when I fell in love with sport.
Great show.
But of course, the sad thing was that it was extremely dangerous. We did lose a lot of drivers. And the circuits were, I mean, if you look at some of those old photographs, you just look at the trees and all the rest of it. And you mentioned Jim Clark, who of course died in a terrible way at Hockenheim when he did go into the trees. And I wouldn't call it glamorous. I'd call it heroic.
Fair enough. That's me told.
No, it isn't at all. I was just bringing out another thing.
No. It's a very fair point.
Well, you actually tied in very well to my next question. Speaking of heroics and people flying the banner of change within the sport with all the changes Jackie Stewart and all the drivers panels have brought forward on safety emphasis, you know, there are now other areas that the paddock are looking at addressing, utilizing their drivers as ambassadors. I actually read an article you wrote in October of last year in your views on the We Races One initiative. And at the time, you said that Lewis has an almost Marmite, quote-unquote, reaction. Do you feel that him being the ambassador for that has kind of helped, hurt that message and muddied it? And where can F1 perpetuate the message and get it out there correctly and drive the points they're trying to make home without it being so ambiguous, almost?
I'm an enormous Lewis Hamilton fan. I'm an enormous Lewis Hamilton fan. I rate him on track. I rate him off track. I think he's the best off track. I think he's, incredibly impressive. And I've known him for quite a while and seen him go from boy to man, really, I suppose you could say. And the extent to which he has taken on board the diversity and inclusion and of course end racism and all that that he's taken on board is fantastic. When I said he was Marmite, I meant some people love him and some people don't. I love him. So I don't want to get into why I think some people might not like him, but I don't think it's for a good reason.
It's not defensible, no.
So I think he's a wonderful ambassador for the sport. And I genuinely think that we will, when he finally hangs his helmet up, whenever that will be, I'd be interested to see what he does do. But I think it'll be interesting and worth watching. And he will not be stilled. He will continue to do things using his platform for the good of mankind. I do think that. And I hope that doesn't sound too naive. I don't think it does. I think that he has taken on board the mantle of his fame and his platform and the fact that he is the only black driver. But, in you know, he does actually also champion other diversity and inclusion elements. It's well known. I'm a gay man, and I am a founder ambassador of Racing Pride, which exists to further the interests of LGBTQ plus people in motorsport, whether they be young carters who are struggling with perhaps bullying, which still sometimes exists, or whether they are people in karting who need to be educated not to do that bullying or to make sure that that bullying doesn't occur, or whether they are engineers or mechanics in their 40s or 50s who have been closeted for 30 years and now feel they can't come out because how could I, having worked for whoever it is, Williams or McLaren or whoever it is, for 20 years, I can't now admit it. Well, you can. You can if you want to. And Racing Pride exists to help you. And I did a tweet not very long ago about that subject, about Racing Pride. And lo and behold, Lewis Hamilton retweeted it. Now, that was remarkable in a number of ways. One, it meant that 6 million people saw my tweet, which is not a common occurrence. But also, you think about it for a second. There is a 30-something heterosexual black superstar, as rich as you could possibly ever want to be, retweeting a middle-aged, middle-class, gay man. He didn't do it to be cool. And probably there may have been some of the other Marmite people who thought, what the hell is he doing retweeting that? But he did it because he believed in it. He did it because he actually believes in diversity and inclusion in every aspect. And I take my hat off to him.
One of your most recent achievements has obviously been the work that you've done with W Series, and I felt absolutely privileged to have been a part of W Series. I wrote about W Series, I previews, race reviews, driver interviews, I enjoyed every single minute of it. But how did the idea of W Series actually come around? Because a lot of our followers know of W Series but may not actually know how the idea and how it all came into fruition.
Well, the idea was Catherine Bonmuir, the current chief executive. And she's a sports lawyer and financier. She'd worked in football, cricket, and sports like that. And then she had a baby quite late in life. She was 45 when she had a baby. And she'd been incredibly hardworking and industrious and successful. And suddenly she was sitting, you know, with a nipper. And she began to think about what she was going to do with her career. And she'd always been a sports fan. She never worked in motor racing, but she began to wonder why it was that there had really been no successful women in motorsport, by and large. And she began to think about it and make plans. And in the end, she got a number of people involved. Sean Wadsworth, who is the largest single shareholder, and his best friend, David Coulthard. And David Coulthard got me involved, and Dave Ryan, who, of course, had worked at McLaren for 34 years as team manager and sporting director, and I knew well as well. So this kind of ex-McLaren crew kind of joined. And I was a bit sceptical at first. I thought, do I really want to be doing this? You know, I've worked with Lewis Hamilton and Jenson Button and Fernando Alonso in Formula One, and we won world championships and all the rest of it. Do I want to be working with these girls, some of whom I don't know, Formula 3 cars? But actually, very soon I became evangelistic about it. And I still think it's one of the best things I've done in my career. And, you know, once you begin to think about it and you realise that Formula One has been in existence for 71 years, and it's always been open to men and women throughout that period. But that in terms of those who have actually started a championship Formula One Grand Prix, out of the nearly 900 odd drivers who have done that, only two have been women. And it's not because of capability, it's because of opportunity. So we wanted to try and improve the opportunity, and we did. And W Series has only had one season so far. Obviously, it's on the Formula One platform this year. Had to take a sabbatical last year because of COVID. But those six races were fantastic. There were 20 drivers. There'll be 20 drivers this year. And they simply wouldn't have had a chance. I mean, I'll just give you one last anecdote on this subject. Alice Powell. Alice Powell had been successful in Formula Renault, good driver in her very early 20s and so on. And then she just ran out of money. And as a result of that, she had to stop. And that meant just stop entirely. She stopped for 3.5 years. And she ended up working as a builder's mate for her dad. Her dad, by the way, just a normal builder. He's the kind of person that would, build a shed in your garden. Anyway, we said, do you want to come and race for us in W Series? She said, do I ever? Yes, I do. And the very first race of W Series was at Hockenheim in May 2019. And she was on the podium, having not raced for 3.5 years. But the week before, she'd been helping her dad build a urinal in a B&B. And he'd been doing the building, and all she'd been doing is taking a sledgehammer to the old one and taking the rubble out in a wheelbarrow. Then she got on the plane to Hockenheim and went and stuck it on the podium. That is the kind of story that is why W Series needs to exist.
And what a race it was. What a race. I absolutely loved that race. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've touched on female drivers in F1, but when are we going to see a female driver, in your opinion, enter the Formula One championship again?
I couldn't tell you when. It may well not be one of the drivers who is currently in W Series. I mean, some of the faster drivers, we obviously just mentioned Alice Powell, knocking 30, poor old girl. And another one of the very fastest drivers there, Emma Kimmelainen, I think is 31 and is a mother. And they're not going to be in Formula One. Let's be honest about it. They're not. If they were 31-year-old men driving extremely well in Formula 3, they wouldn't make it to Formula One. That's not going to happen. We realise that. So we have to look at the younger ones. And I think Marta Garcia, who is probably now 19, I would say, you might need to check that, but very quick, great potential. I'm not saying she's going to be in Formula One. It might be that the next or first woman for all these years who enters Formula One is now 15 and will be somebody who I would think and hope does use W Series as a stepping stone to gain the experience and to race on the Formula One platform, but in Formula 3 cars. But so much of it is about money. We know that, international single-seater motorsport has become a bit of a... It's difficult in that sense. It is very difficult for drivers to get on. And often... with girls, it seems to have been harder because they didn't. You might think they would get the sponsorship and the breaks, but they don't seem to, or hadn't seemed to, is what we'd noticed. So W Series exists also to organically shine a light on the issue, and also to encourage youngsters, young girls, to say to their mums and dads, instead of saying, buy me a pony, I want to go show jumping, buy me a kart, I want to go. And organically, if a larger number of young girls do that, then surely a larger number will percolate their way up through. Because at the moment, there are girls who go karting and they're as good as the boys, but they're outnumbered. But if the numbers were better balanced and they were more represented, then who knows what might happen. Mm-hmm. All I can tell you is that when it finally happens, whether it's in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or 8 years, when you're sitting on your sofa on a Sunday afternoon and you hear the following broadcast, you hear, today in Monte Carlo, Jenny Jenkins won the Monaco Grand Prix. Second was Lance Stroll. Third was Sebastian Vettel. Then she will become instantly the biggest star in the whole world. That's worth working for, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It really is.
Those of our listeners, and you've just touched upon it as well, is that you recently wrote a book, and I actually have it here. I've read the first 2.5 chapters of it, and I am hooked already. I can't read more than one book at once because I've just finished my Bernie Eccleston book, so I started.
A bit different, a little bit different.
Yeah, because. It's gripping and it's beautifully written. Even in the first couple of chapters, I'm reading it. I just can't put it down. But tell us a bit about.
It's extremely sweet. Really, I'm very chuffed. I'm very touched. I really am. It means a lot.
But just tell us a little bit about the plot line and what sort of motivated you and inspired you to write it.
My mother, God rest her, was a novelist. And her mother, my grandmother, was a novelist. And so I was brought up around books, brought up to read voraciously and love books. I started in Formula One as a writer, as a journalist, and I loved the word smithery. I loved the weighing of the words and finding a way to bring out the characters of the characters I was writing about, whether it was Michael Schumacher or Damon Hill, Mika Häkkinen, back in that era. And so I loved that. And then I immersed myself in working for teams. And then my chapter at McLaren came to an end, and I didn't immediately embark on W Series. I had a few months where I was thinking what to do. And I thought to myself, I know, I'll write a novel. It's in my blood, and I think I have an idea. And I'm not necessarily particularly skint, so I don't particularly need to earn money from it. I'll have to earn money again, which I now thankfully am. Thank you, Mr. Strong. But it wasn't necessarily an immediate priority. And I thought, I have an opportunity to write something and I would like proceeds to go to charity because my mother has died. And I started an appeal, the Bernadine Bishop appeal. That was her name, Bernadine Bishop. So I decided to write a book, all proceeds of which would go to charity, and they are. And luckily the money's rolling in nicely. So all the royalties are going to charity. To the Bernadine Bishop appeal, which fundraises for Click Sargent, which is a cancer charity for children. And, I mean, what could be more deserving than a charity that works with children who have cancer? So that was the reason. Then what to write? Well, I'm a gay man and I'm 58. So that means that I was alive and lived through, but many didn't, the crisis of HIV/AIDS in the late 80s and early 90s. And I lost many friends. And I also volunteered for an organization called London Lighthouse, which at that time was the largest HIV/AIDS center in the world. Doesn't exist anymore. It's the London Museum of Brands now, the same building. Isn't that a sign of the times, how things have changed? Anyway, at that time, it was like the First World War. You know, young men were dying. It's a bit like this series you may have watched on Channel 4 called It's a Sin. And young men were dying in their late teens or early 20s. And it was like the First World War. I mean, the First World War, of course, those who died were celebrated and venerated and later decorated. But some of the young men who died of HIV/AIDS in the late 80s and early 90s died despised and rejected, disgraced, lonely. I mean, really very, very sad, isn't it? Very, very sad. Now, that is the narrative book backdrop of my book. I've now made it sound like the most single depressing book that you could ever possibly read. But I really think it isn't. That is the narrative backdrop, but the central narrative cell, C-E-L-L cell, is a family, mum, dad, and son. And there are three other main characters. I've always wanted to write a novel. I have written a novel. You know, if I wanted to open a restaurant, I'd want to open the kind of restaurant that I'd want to eat in. So when you write a novel, you want to kind of write the kind of novel that you'd want to read. So for me, a small number of characters, a lot of dialogue. The action starts straight away. Emma, you will confirm.
Yes.
It's not, when I say action, I mean, it's not gunslinging action. It's just that even in chapter one, you probably go, ooh, oh.
I made that exact face.
And then in chapter two, when you realize that a rather cataclysmic mistake has been made, you probably make an even more accentuated version of that face. Would you agree, Emma?
Yeah, I would, yeah.
So I wanted to set up, I always love dramatic irony. So there is a cataclysmic error, which most of the characters are unaware of, but the reader is aware of, and one of the characters is aware of. And everything unfolds from that cataclysmic mistake. And there are some sad things in it. There are some funny things in it. But I wanted to write, I always, there had been a great oeuvre, genre of books, novels, fictional novels, written about HIV/AIDS at the time when it was a crisis. And luckily, thank goodness, when antiretroviral meds were invented in the mid-1990s, those novels stopped being written. And I understood why, but I always wanted to write one. I always wanted to read one. Again, I'd read a lot of them, the ones that were written at the time, but I wanted to read another one, and no one kept writing one. So I thought, if I want to read one, I'll have to write one myself, then read it. So that's what I've done. But actually, it turns out that Russell T. Davis was doing the same thing at the same time. Although my book came out before It's a Sin, It's a Sin has been hugely successful on Channel 4. And some people have been very kind. For instance, Darren Stiles, who's the editor of the men's gay lifestyle magazine Attitude, he tweeted, "If you love him, It's a Sin, you'll love The Boy Made the Difference," which is my novel. And in fact, sales did increase as a result of It's a Sin being aired, which I'm sure was the reason. But it all goes to charity, so there you are. If you've bothered to listen to me so far, rabbiting on about Formula One and all the rest of it, you know, spend £8.99 on The Boy Made the Difference. It's available in Amazon or paperback. Sorry, it's a Kindle or paperback via Amazon. And I won't get a penny piece, but the money you spend will go to help children with cancer. And you might even enjoy the read.
That's a very reasonable
price. I'm certainly enjoying it. It's, you know, it doesn't shy away from the issues from the 80s and 90s with HIV and AIDS. And the book is, it's certainly an eye-opener for me, even though I've only read the first few chapters. I was born in 1984, so I don't remember, all of what happened with HIV and AIDS. My mum and dad remember, but I don't. I was far too young. But do you think it's important to show people who hadn't necessarily lived through it the true reality of it?
Absolutely. My husband is younger than me. He's in his 30s. And so, you know, like you, he didn't really know about that. He'd heard of it, but he didn't really know what it was like. And I suppose when I got to know him and love him and his friends, who are his age, I began to realise that they really didn't know what it was like for gay men my age when we were their age. And it wasn't fun. And I began to tell them, they were like, really? Yes, that's what it was like, yes. Mm. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, to do that, and to, via a fictional vehicle, perhaps help tell that story, which It's a Sin, as of course, has done on a much larger and grander scale. But I also wanted to do it as, in a way, as a tribute to some of the people who I remember and miss. And I think that some of them, you know, it's an extraordinary thing, dying young. It's a terrible, terrible thing. It's not much worse in the world. And I think the courage that they showed, some of the people I remember, who, by the way, were the kind of people who would be perfectly capable of having a ridiculous hissy fit about having their Reebok Classics scuffed on the way to heaven, but nonetheless faced their deaths with enormous fortitude. And actually, I find that contrast very moving and touching. And yes, I think knowledge is important. And if people find out about things like that and learn more about things like that, it's good for everyone. It's good for the planet. You can only benefit from learning.
That's fascinating. I mean, I was born in 2000, so I was never told about this in school. In fact, I vividly remember an RE lesson when it's about that much of a paragraph. And also in my lifetime, the treatment of gay people generally has been, you know, I haven't had to live through the massive culture of, I don't know, just general dislike, or maybe that's too soft a word. I think that sounds absolutely fascinating, because for people like me who are, you know, who might be listening to this podcast, for example, because obviously they're interested in F1, maybe that's a takeaway that, well, I mean, I certainly wasn't expecting, and I hope a lot of younger people weren't, but...
Well, there you go, you see. More than one string to one's bow is not a bad idea, is it? Write a novel. Everyone who's listening, have a go at it.
God, I don't think mine would sell many copies, but I'll give it a go. I'll give it a go.
Another work that you were attributed to, sir, is the autobiographical Emo.
Oh, yeah.
You're credited with. After having read that, I have to fanboy a little bit about that. Were you approached to help with that book, or was that something that you sought out to undertake and get involved with?
I've never earned any money out of any books, because I didn't earn money out of this one either. And that's because I was working at McLaren in 2013, and I began to think about how we were going to plan to celebrate the 40-year anniversary of the team's first world championship, which was Emerson Fittipaldi in 1974. And we didn't have a lot of budget. You might find that surprising, but, you know, Formula One teams spend a lot of money, but it doesn't mean they always have a lot of budget for individual projects. And Ron Dennis, bless him, not an enormous fan of anything that happened at McLaren prior to the autumn of 1980, if I can put it that way. In other words, when he took over. So not particularly thrilled about the idea of spending a lot of money on a promotion of a 1974 event. But we knew that we had to celebrate it. And the race that most closely approximated to the 40-year anniversary was Monza 2014. Because, of course, Emerson won the championship at Watkins Glen in 1974, but it was in early September as well. So we worked out that we would try and celebrate McLaren 40, as we unoriginally called it, at Monza. And I thought, I'd love to get Emo there. I'd love to get him there. But, you know, he lives in Miami, and he's going to need to be flown there, and he's probably going to want a big day rate, you know. Why not? Everybody's in the business of being paid, except me, it would appear. But, although I am paid, but not for writing books. Anyway, so I obviously I knew Emerson, and I put something to him. I said, look, if I wrote a book for you and got it published via my old mates at Haymarket, and I won't take a fee, and you can share the profits with Haymarket on all sales, then will you come to the 2014 Italian Grand Prix to be celebrating not only the launch of the book, because we'll do that as part of McLaren 40, but also to be, you know, I was there and McLaren 40, I'm the man and blah, 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 and be interviewed by journalists and so on. He said, yes, I will. So that's how we managed to get Emerson Fittipaldi to celebrate McLaren 40 by me writing a book for him, which he could share the profits with Haymarket. Nothing to do, so McLaren didn't have to pay him. Actually, it was an enormous pleasure to write it with him. We did it on the telephone. I just rang him lots of times. And the extraordinary thing is his memory. His memory for detail. Incredible detail. The gearbox failed in the spare car at Mosport in 75, but luckily, all that stuff. I'd say, are you reading this from some diary? No, I remember all of these. Absolutely all of them. Anyway, I'll tell you a little story because I'm a huge Emerson fan, both driver and man. But during the course of the time we were both writing it, his father and my mother both died. And the only part of the book that I didn't write, he said, I'm going to write an author's note. He said, I said, well, I'll ghost that for you, like all the rest of it. He said, no, I'll get someone else to ghost that for me. I thought, that's a bit weird. Why would you do that? Okay. Anyway, he got someone else to ghost that for him. And in it, I'll read the last paragraph of it. It's very short. Just the last paragraph. And this was a surprise to me, which he included in the author's note or the author's preface. He said, yes, and he says that Matt Bishop wrote it with me. We wrote it together throughout 2013 and the early part of 2014. And although we'd met each other quite a few times before that, we've grown closer via our many phone calls in recent years. As we were writing the book in 2013, both of us received unhappy news. On the 11th of March 2013, I lost my beloved father, Wilson Fittipaldi Sr., a sports broadcaster who first instilled in me a love of racing. He was at Monza commentating for Brazilian TV as I crossed the line to win the 1972 Italian Grand Prix and become Brazil's first ever Formula One world champion. And on the 4th of July 2013, Matt lost his beloved mother, Bernadine Bishop, a skilled and sensitive novelist who first instilled in him a love of writing. She would have been so pleased and proud to read the book that her son and I have created together. It's dedicated to both of them. To Wilson and Bernadine, let perpetual light shine upon them, and may they rest in peace.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really, really touching.
That's Emerson, you see. That's the side of Emerson you don't always see.
Mm.
So contrarian to the nature that we're all expected to believe, I guess is the way I'll phrase that. The hard-nosed, bare-knuckle racer, but same way that The Boy Who Made the Difference and that message all come together is that everybody has a soul, there's a purpose behind everything, and everybody can achieve a higher sense of purpose. And I think you are a keen embodiment of that.
Well, that's very sweet of you. I would reject it on the basis that it's far too kind. But all one can do is do one's best.
Well, Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, and I appreciate you spending more time than we'd planned together. It's been a really interesting insight. So thank you very much. On behalf of everyone.
I'm touched, the four of you spending your time as well.
And we wish you the absolute best with Aston Martin this year. I certainly can't wait to see, firstly, what the car looks like. And I know that I've seen so many renders online of, is it going to be this shade of green? Is it going to be this shade? Matt, what shade is it going to be?
It's going to be green, dude.
Oh, wow.
Brilliant. I tried. Okay. But no, thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you. All the best to you.
Podcast Network.